Three, two, one.
Welcome, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, one and all. So we've done it again, guys. We got another big guy here today, so I'm sure you guys will recognize him. We have Derek of Veritasium. So you guys should know this gentleman here. He's got several physics channels. He also, you know, has Veritasium on Instagram, Veritasium on Twitter, I believe, as well. And the website, Veritasium.com. Derek, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Welcome to the Eigen Bros podcast, featuring Eigen Ketz as well for our fans. This is a physics podcast, as which is, they're very rare to begin with. But, you know.
You guys got to be in the top few physics podcasts
That's
globally.
Right, by default.
By default.
Yeah.
Juan, can you turn my headphones down a little
bit?
Yeah,
I got you.
Appreciate
it,
man. So, Derek, yeah, man, we're so glad to have you out here, man. I know you were, we were talking earlier about your quarantine situation, but how you hanging in there, man? Pretty good?
Yeah, I'm all right. You know, I feel like I'm in a really fortunate position. California is not a bad place to ride out, you know, stay-at-home orders and stuff like that. And, you know, as I was saying to you guys, it's given me a chance to sort of spend a couple months with my kids, almost uninterrupted time, which is both like really good. And it also, you know, at a point, it's like, I got to get back to work. I got to get back to doing some science. So,
yeah,
right,
you know, I'm sort of doing that transition now.
Yeah.
You can't recruit the kids to help you out on some of the videos?
Maybe in a few years. We'll see.
Yeah, are you inundating them with like physics knowledge and they're like, just dad,
stop.
We've heard about the solar system 1,000 times.
Yeah, they got a lot of books about space and about rockets and gravity, and there's a lot of a space theme around the house. They seem to be pretty into it though, so that's good.
That is good.
Yeah, some of just for the audience, I don't know, some people may not know, Derek, your wife is also a planetary scientist as well, correct?
That's right, yeah. So she drives a lot of this sort of interest in space, astronomy, getting the telescope out. You know, when SpaceX was launching, we had that up, you know, on a projector in the living room so they could check it out. So, yeah.
Fantastic.
Definitely a sort of a space-heavy family.
Cool.
Very nice. Yeah, me and Juan were actually in Florida, so we tried to go down for the first launch. Yeah. Unfortunately, it was scrubbed, and we had to come back, and we missed it the second time around, so tear was shed.
We were trying to be a part
of this. Yeah, that's so sad, man. Yeah. Get down to 17 minutes before it's going to go, and...
Yeah, that's a bummer, but next time.
Fine. Yeah, maybe next time.
Maybe the Mars mission.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, Derek, so we wanted to get a little bit of understanding what your background is, man. So I know you went to university in Canada, and you also went in Australia, I believe, but you're also a PhD in physics education. So could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, my background's a little weird. I call myself the Commonwealth kid a little bit because my parents are South African. My family goes back a long way in South Africa. But then my family moved to Canada and then to Australia where I was born and then back to Canada, you know, when I was about 2 years old. So I'm mostly Canadian, but I also have sort of pieces of Australia, South Africa. And so I grew up in Canada. I went to university, did my undergrad at Queen's University in Canada, engineering physics, which was a pretty good program. And then I moved to Australia straight after graduating. And I kind of wanted to be in a creative industry. You know, I wanted to be making films or something like that. But I just thought that, you know, being a sort of traditional filmmaker was a poor career choice. Like, I thought it's really hard to break into that industry. It also felt to me like it wasn't a meritocracy. You know, I felt like I was good at science and that was a meritocracy. You know, you get ahead by, you know, doing the work and being able to figure stuff out, you know, so it felt like I could do those sorts of things. I just didn't know about breaking into a creative career. So, you know, ended up in Australia thinking like, I want to merge my interest in, you know, being a filmmaker with also my passion for science and my ability to do that kind of work. And that's where the PhD came in, with this idea of like, maybe I can make a PhD around how to teach physics with film. That was sort of the concept going into it. And the challenge of a PhD is like it absorbs your whole life. And I didn't feel like it really managed to allow me to make cool films. And it also didn't allow me to do hardcore science research. So it was a, it was a really tough thing that like didn't end up really hitting where I wanted it to. But long term, it has served me very well to have, you know, a background and years of sort of studying and looking at the literature around, you know, creating media that helps people learn. So it has turned out to be useful. I worked for a while at a tutoring company while I was doing my PhD, and I worked full time for them after that for about 2 or 3 years. And at some point, I got to this point in my life where I was like probably 27, 28 years old, and I thought, you know, this whole, my whole life, I've told myself, like, I want to be creative. I want to be making films. That's what I, you know, dream of doing. And yet I've sort of focused on doing very sort of safe things all the way up, you know, getting engineering and getting a PhD. And it just felt like, you know, I was always doing something that was like the smart choice in the moment, as opposed to something that fit with what my deep underlying passions were. And so, I quit my job at the end of 2010. And I thought, like, you know, if I don't embrace this now, when am I going to do it? And so I just started making YouTube videos. And that's sort of like how it all started. And it's just snowballed from there.
Very interesting. Kind of, so you're actually a media guy first and foremost. I was wondering why it listed you that way on your Wikipedia.
I wanted to be creative. I wanted to be like, you know, growing up, I did plays, you know, I was into theater, I was into film, you know, animations, whatever, stuff like that. Like, I don't know. I like that, the sort of art of storytelling and that craft. I also like, you know, a project-based workflow where it's like, right now, this is the project, and it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it goes out in the world, there's some response or whatever, and I get to move on and do the next one. Mm-hmm. So I really like that sort of workflow. I personally found research quite stifling for my personality that, you know, it feels like the kind of place where you could spend 6 months or a year or 2 years and like, it's all wasted at the end of that, you know, like you could find that you were going down a dark, you know, a blind alley kind of thing, and like it doesn't work out. And then you got to go back and start again. For me, like, that's a really tough thing for me to handle. And so I much prefer this sort of ability to turn things around more rapidly and sort of have an engagement with a large group of people. Like, I really enjoy that. It works with my personality.
I see. Yeah. You're in a good space here, Derek, because we're very much in that same kind of creative physicist sphere, and that's kind of one thing I've longed for with physics, was more of a creative element. I mean, there's a lot of creativity that can go into physics, but there is something true about what you're saying, where it feels kind of stifling in some sense, where you're just all physics and it makes it so you can't really branch out to do a lot of other things, especially in PhD. So, I can definitely commiserate with you very much on that.
I'm kind of intrigued about, because you said you had this like dream of doing film, but why the 180 to science? Like, until that point,
I don't think it was a major 180 for me. Like, I liked a challenge. You know, I also feel like at the core of my personality is some sort of competitiveness, like a real deep competitiveness, that whatever I saw anyone doing, I was like, oh yeah, they can do that. Well, I can do that better. You know, like I felt this need to do that. And part of that is the physicist mindset, right? Like, physicists think that they can solve everyone's problems better than they can solve them. Like, you know, it's like physics is everything, man. Like, it's chemistry and, you know, it's biology, whatever. Like, those are just little pieces of physics that have, you know, in particular zones or whatever. I think physicists are generally arrogant because of this sort of worldview that, like, yeah, everything falls under the rubric of physics and we can solve it all. So I guess, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I wanted to compete at different things. And like, I was pretty good at school. So I worked hard at that. And, you know, I did well. And I enjoyed science because it made sense. And because there were some, you know, deep regularities that we could understand about our world, like, that really appealed to me. So, you know, and I guess like a core part of me is also like this search for truth and this belief that, like, if we can figure out what's actually going on and the way things actually work, we can all lead better lives. And so science plays a big role in that. So, you know, in high school, I was really good at science. And, you know, I graduated top of my class and finished, you know, very high up in biology, physics, chemistry, sort of triple threat. And the logical thing to do at university was to continue that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, it wasn't a 180. It was just that, like, you know, science was something I felt I was good at and I could demonstrate ability in, but like, what brought me more joy was, you know, being in a theater production or doing a musical or, you know, I don't know, making a short film or something like that. That brought me a lot of satisfaction above and beyond what science could.
Mm. So, Derek, do you actually have any, hidden gems of short films you've done out there?
I wouldn't say hidden gems. There's like this horrible, horrible stuff that I did. You know, when I was in university with my buddies, we would make like these stupid little comedy sketches and things like that. We made about 25 videos in the course of 2 or 3 years. And we were all like engineering students, so like the acting's not great, but we made videos. My buddies always wanted to make something with like a gimmick, and it was always like looking at what was popular in the minute. So, you know, we made videos about vampires or, you know, pirates or,
right,
you know, yeah, or like Yeti, Bigfoot, that sort of stuff. Like we did really silly things. What?
Any zombies? Zombies.
There were no zombies. I feel like zombies weren't a thing. Like we were making this between like 2002, 2004, like that kind of time period.
Oh, okay.
Like YouTube didn't exist yet. So like my buddy was creating our own server, which ran out of like an old computer in our closet upstairs. And we were like, you know, exporting our videos so that people could watch them around campus. And we were like putting stickers up so people would know to come to our website. Cause like we had to try to get web traffic somehow so people would come and see this stuff. Amazing. But like, it wasn't great. You know, it was just like, it was a training ground for us.
Yeah.
And so, I would love to see some of those videos.
Yeah. Same.
They're really bad. They're really bad.
But that gave you some experience in a sense, yeah, right? Going into YouTube,
I guess. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. But I mean like that was, yeah, super early, but you know, I was into like, I bought a camera, I had the editing, you know, software and stuff, and so I was doing a lot of the kind of like directing my friends into, you know, this is roughly the story, but like I would pick all the shots and like set it up and tell them what to do, and then I'd get home and put it all together. So yeah, I guess you could consider that early experience, but you know, you could look at my videos from 2010 or 2011 when I really started doing YouTube full time, and like,
yeah,
they weren't very good. So for as much experience and as much time I'd spent, you know, mm-hmm, performing and working on stuff like this, I still like was pretty noob when I started in 2011. So, you know, even so, it's come a long way in the last 10 years.
How do you feel like physics helped you, in this career path that you took, like in terms of just the creative aspect of doing film and, you know, doing stuff at Netflix and things like that? Mm-hmm.
I mean, the biggest way that it's helped me is it's kind of made me a subject matter expert in the things that I talk about.
Right.
So I guess that's a big piece. I don't know if understanding physics has had any impact on like the creative side. I feel like that's almost like it's a different subject altogether, a different skill set or something. Like it's, I think of them kind of separately, but you know, definitely the subject matter, yeah, which is, you know, what I talk about. So
right,
mostly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know you, we were looking, of course, through your Wikipedia, and I saw some of the people who you work with, and I didn't realize you, worked with Bill Nye on his, thing. How was that?
Yeah. That was cool. That was really cool. You know, when I grew up, we would watch Bill's show in like eighth grade science.
Yeah.
And I had this teacher who had Jolly Ranchers, like a big bag of them. And we would watch like an episode. And then at the end, he would ask us questions that like were answered in the episode. And if you got it right, he would throw Jolly Ranchers at you. So
nice.
Like, I feel like, I don't know if people be allowed to do that these days, but back in those days, like, I guess we weren't so worried about sugar, but, but like he was a cool science teacher, and that was like a fun thing that we would do.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So yeah. So I guess he was like an early science hero of mine. Getting to work alongside him was a lot of fun, and he's a great guy to work with and hang out with. And yeah.
Yeah. And did you crack open a beer and was like, Bill, 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 Bill.
You know, he had like Halloween parties at his house and stuff like
that.
Nice. Like he's fun, and I consider him like, you know, he's like Uncle Bill, and he's hung out with my kids too, and he's really he's a good sort of like that kind of uncle character.
Right.
But no, he's great. Yeah. And he's like a legend of science and science communication and TV. So it was a real like pleasure just to work with him.
Cool.
Very cool. I do wonder how many beers Bill could chug. But
mathematically, given his height and BMI, maybe you can approximate.
But anyway, so yeah, it was interesting actually too, Derek, thinking about the comedic stuff. So you were saying you did the comedy videos in the past. I actually saw your appearance on Tiger Belly too, which I thought was very interesting and kind of unexpected.
Yeah,
because I didn't know that you guys were going to be doing that, and those worlds colliding was kind of interesting. How was it?
Interesting for
Bobby
me too.
Lee?
Friends, they're friends of friends, so yeah, no, someone made the connection and I was like, sure, whatever, I'll have a conversation.
So it was kind of just random off the cuff.
Yeah which is like most of this stuff, which is just really
it was cool though, because I thought it was hilarious how he was asking you so many medical doctor questions. I was like, does he know any other doctor besides a medical doctor?
Yeah, Bobby's so funny though. So,
but definitely out of my depth.
But you have met him in real life, right?
Yeah. We went to a wedding together. So, yeah.
Right.
That's cool.
Okay. Very interesting though. But on the physics train again, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of your older videos there, Derek. So you. One of your videos, man, is like, it's one of my top videos. The one that you did on the logistic map. So that one was completely mind-blowing to me. And just being able to see the relationship between the logistic map and the Mandelbrot set, I thought that was really crazy, man. How did you even come up with that idea?
You know, certain things come across my plate and they tickle something inside me, probably the same way they did with you, right? And I feel like I need to make a video about them. So the origin of that video probably goes back like 12, 13 years and reading the book Chaos by James Gleick, which is a really cool book and I recommend it to everyone, you know. I didn't know as much about chaos. Like I kind of came through and I knew a little bit about it, but like reading that book really opened my eyes. And I remember there were some topics in there that I really wanted to get back to. And so, yeah, just looking at the logistic map and I mean, he mentions the Mandelbrot set and stuff in that book. But then I was like, well, how does this really pertain to the Mandelbrot set? And then trying to figure out what happens to those numbers as they stay finite or don't, and realizing that that is the same mapping as the logistic map. I mean, that stuff, I mean, it's crazy cool. You can find that sort of stuff in Wikipedia, but it's normally not told in a sort of storytelling way where you get this sort of like bigger sense that the universe has some deep structure. So that's like my goal in sort of creating this video is to say, this is what I think is really cool and this is why, and putting all those pieces together in a way that hopefully takes you to a place, you know, mentally and also maybe emotionally that you know, makes you feel as excited as I felt.
Mm-hmm.
Making that video was almost like one of the longest times that I put into a video, because I would film sections and then like put them in the timeline and realize that they didn't quite do what I wanted, or like I was working with my animator and telling him I wanted certain things and I look at them and like they weren't quite hitting. And so, you know, it's funny, for a video about like iterations, it was one of my most iterated videos, because I would like keep making stuff and keep shooting stuff and then just like scrapping it and then like starting again.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's tricky to sort of get across the idea that you really want in a way that feel satisfying to me, but I'm pleased with where that video got to. So I'm glad you felt the same thing.
Oh yeah, when that Mandelbrot flipped, I mean, I threw up every. I was just like, all right, that's it.
Yeah, he flipped the table.
Yeah, It was next level. It's so cool.
It's when I see that those moments exist. It's when I see those things that I'm like, oh, this has to be a video. And I have to make this. And I just become kind of obsessed with it until it's done. So, yeah, that's how that went down with that one.
Yeah, that was very cool. Very cool.
So, since you did your PhD in physics education, do you have this... I mean, your videos are obviously a sign that you can dissect these ideas and make them palatable to a wider audience, but would you ever want to go, like, get a university job at some point and, like, teach physics?
So I actually did lecture for a while, particularly at UTS, University of Technology, Sydney, and I taught their first year physics course for non-majors. It was like a 400-seat lecture kind of course. And I enjoyed that. Like, I enjoyed the performance aspect of teaching and being a lecturer. I don't know if that's somewhere I would go back to. I kind of feel like my classroom has expanded.
Yeah.
You know, when I was growing up, I used to tutor like people just for fun because I enjoyed the whole teaching process. I enjoy helping people understand things, and you know, that's continued through to this day. But I used to do it in like a one-on-one format or a one-on-two or whatever. And then at some point I was at this tutoring company where we had classes of up to 14. So that was the typical size. And then when I was lecturing, it was up to 400. And then pretty soon, you know, it became 400,000 and 4 million. And, you know, that's really exciting to me, you know, to try to reach a really broad audience. So I feel like that's the direction that I'm going. At the same time, you know, it is always fun to like be in the room with people, and I enjoy that too. So, you know, sometimes I go and give talks for teachers or for, you know, rare student groups. Mostly it's for teachers, I think, these days. And like, I really enjoy doing that. So I do enjoy being in the room with people, but I wouldn't see it as sort of a regular ongoing thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Never say never. Who knows what'll happen?
Yeah. I look at the videos and the catalog of videos that you've made, and I think, like, you know, here's a guy who like can get these concepts and then break them down and make them digestible and stuff. And as a TA me and Terrence have both been TAs, and I kind of want to know if there's like a guiding set of principles that you use in terms of like to teaching physics.
I don't know if there's a guiding set of principles. It's interesting to come out of physics education and think like, all right, there's some things that you can say scientifically about teaching. I can give you a couple examples.
Sure.
I mean, some of the major things that come to mind, I made this video, The Science of Thinking, which was originally called The Uncomfortable Effort of Thinking. But it's the same idea about, like, how do we think? How do we learn? I mean, there's some fundamental things about our psychology which I feel like kind of get marginalized because they're so easy and so well known. For example, I think one of the core things anyone has to know about the way our brains work is that we handle about, you know, 4 novel pieces of information at a time, max. You know, the old idea was like, oh, the number is 7. But like, the more people have researched this and looked at like what really counts as novel and how do you measure novelty, etc., they bring it down to 4. And it's probably less than that in terms of like our ability to sort of take new concepts and sort of manipulate them and move them around and sort of think about them in our brains. It's because our working memory capacity is, you know, fundamentally very limited. Simultaneously, you have a huge library of prior knowledge, which is almost, you know, infinite if you think about how many gigabytes or terabytes could be stored in there. So like,
right,
we have this insane sort of long-term storage and this, you know, very finite short-term storage. So, you know, one of the things I would say about an approach to teaching is it's got to be an approach that sort of meets people where they are. If they have some prior knowledge about the subject, that needs to sort of be brought to the fore. If it's incorrect prior knowledge, that needs to be brought to the fore, which is why I think any of these conversations around teaching fundamental physics around, you know, forces in motion, you have to deal with these fundamental misconceptions around, you know, okay, so if I'm in my car, I need to push down on the accelerator, so I'm applying a force to my car, and that's what keeps it moving, right? A force to keep something moving is a fundamental concept that basically everyone has. To switch that over from, you know, balanced forces maintain motion or no net forces maintain motion is a real shift. Mm-hmm. And it messes with people's heads. Fundamentally, the idea of inertia is very, 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 very difficult for people.
Yes.
So And yeah. So you know, for me, it's always been about, like, a really big part of this is I need to limit the amount of novel information. Then I need to get people to practice this sort of thing that I'm trying to get them to learn. And then I need them to master it before we go on and do something else. A fundamental issue with all introductory physics courses is the idea of acceleration, which is almost impossible to perceive. Like, you don't look at a falling object and say, I see that thing speeding up. You only know that because, well, once you know physics, you understand why it should be speeding up and why it should, its velocity should be zero when you let go and faster when you catch it. And even though that, like, you think, like, oh, it should be obvious. Like, I can see it. I'm a physicist. I can see it. But the new people coming into it, like, if you actually look at the observations, they can't see it. So if you don't see acceleration, you can't perceive it. And then you're going to do a whole bunch of math calculations around this concept. And you think you know what it is, but actually you're thinking of acceleration as though it's a velocity, which you can more readily see. Then you bring all sorts of incorrect ideas in, and everything gets mumbled. Mm-hmm. I see this you know, a lot of people come out of physics, like their first physics course or something, and they say, like, I'm just not a physics person. And they also say things like, you know, I thought I got it, and then I got to the test, and I got everything wrong. Like, all of these types of observations, for me, align with this concept of, like, it's easy to fool yourself into thinking you know what it is, or because you're just sort of thinking about your preconceptions are what you think is the way the world works, and those have to be challenged. I don't know. So there are some general principles. I think, like, largely the things we do wrong is we have these 1-hour lectures in physics where a lot of novel information is presented, and you lose everyone. And
yeah.
Maybe they think they understand it because they already had ideas about this beforehand, but their prior ideas are not being challenged, and a whole bunch of novel stuff's being introduced. And to the lecture, it all makes sense because they have these very complex structures in long-term memory, making it seem like it's not that novel. But if you're not, you know, this is the problem of the expert. If you have those structures, you can't see the world the same way that the novice does. So those are all the ways in which I think we get it wrong. And yeah. I think, like, for me, I want to see a lot of small chunks of information followed by a lot of practice and mastery before we move on to the next thing. So I'd say those are sort of the biggest things to hit.
Very good list.
That's an interesting challenge to universities then, I guess, if they move.
Huge.
Yeah.
Dang. So one thing I've noticed, Derek, when I was in graduate school, I really kind of started to really realize how much I didn't value lectures. so I was like, it just felt like I was going there to just basically show my face and get in good graces with my professor, and that was pretty much it. Do you think that have you, since you are in education, I would imagine you've probably thought of, is there something that you believe to supersede the lecture? Or do you think the lecture is pretty good, but it just needs maybe some tweaking or what? What's your take on that?
I have so many thoughts. I mean,
excellent.
One thought is, you know, when I was doing my undergrad, first year high school, I never skipped a class. My first year university, I went to barely half of them. In second year, I remember I taught my friends to crochet. We used to go to our applied physics lectures and sit there and, like, crochet mittens and hats. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
I had a buddy who in the first year calculus lecture, he was, like, reading Moby Dick in the first row because we were jerks like that.
That's so funny.
But, okay, so a couple things. One is that I feel like lectures in the right hands can be great and lectures in the wrong hands can be terrible. You know, it's kind of like this thing about, like, are books better than movies or are lectures better than, like, interactive computer programs? Mm-hmm. The answer is always, like, what actually depends on what's the lecture doing. You know, if you were to look at my lectures when I gave lectures, I actually handed out physical pieces of paper cards, one that said A, B, and C, and another one that said C, D, so that people could hold up cards. I would ask them questions as I was going. And when I was teaching to a group of 14, the way I would approach my class is, you know, I don't want to say anything that I think my students can say for me. So I'd always be like, you know, starting my lecture or starting my class with sort of recaps of where we're at and just rapid firing, you know, at like a random assortment of students to get them to like activate, tell me what they're thinking. So I think like that's a very effective way to teach and to learn is like people have to be thinking about it and they have to be engaged. They have to be switched on. They have to be attentive. And there are various like tools you can use to do that. For me, like the more you can ask questions of the students as you go and get feedback immediately, like, the better off you are. So I guess that's my thinking. I don't know if there's anything that supersedes the lecture. I have been very anti a move to like online or like a computer tutor or something like that. And I feel like the whole COVID experience is going to bear me out on this, where like a lot of people are trying to switch over to online learning. The teachers are finding it's a lot harder to teach this way, and the students are finding it's a lot harder to learn this way, because fundamentally we're social animals. We like to be in a room with other people. We like to, you know, if we're going to work on something, we need to feel accountable to someone. Like someone's going to look at, you know, check our homework,
yeah,
and you know, tell us that we need to be better, or tell us we need to work harder, or tell us like you need to do problems, you know, 1 through 5 or whatever. It just becomes very difficult for anyone when it's just sort of self-directed. It's the same reason why like gyms are everywhere, but people aren't ripped, you know, if they got a gym membership. But if you got a personal trainer, then you can move up, you know, because that personal trainer is someone you're accountable to. You're setting the time to meet with that person, as you know, like all those things I feel like fit with our psychology much better, mm-hmm, than this idea of like, you know, there's textbooks out there. People aren't just typically learning GR out of a textbook. It happens, but it's not the common way. You know, it's much better to have a lecturer who can, you know, help you parse it and tell you what you need to be studying next and, you know, answer any questions and stuff like that. So, you know, I don't know. I feel like a classroom experience can be the best learning experience. Typically, you know, smaller classes, the better, but, you know, economics are, you know, what they are, and that's the challenge.
Interesting. You make some good points there. It seems accountability is a very critical part to that whole system. And then also, like you said, the whole lecturer depends on the person. Mm-hmm. But then I kind of wonder, is there
it's like a video. You know, when I looked at my videos, like I made some videos that were totally useless for learning. And I made some videos that could double people's pretest score. And then if you looked at like their perceptions of the video or their perceptions of the learning experience, they were the same. Like how much did their confidence increase in the accuracy of their answers? The same. But like one group learned nothing and the other group doubled their score. So my point being that like that was a nice contained little 5-minute video or whatever.
Right.
But you can make a video that makes people feel like they're learning and makes them feel good and more confident. And you can also make a video that actually makes them learn.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah. So like I feel like I have the data to say like, you know, it depends on what's in the presentation. You know, it depends what's in the lecture.
Huh. Yeah. I never thought about that one. That's really interesting. Can we go on that one a little bit? So I'm kind of curious. What do you think were the factors, the big factors that were in place that made a video make you feel like
more effective?
Learning?
Oh yeah. So just any kind of like clear presentation. So I tried this with Newton's laws, for example, just really basic. Because at University of Sydney, there's about 800 or 900 students who come in and do a first year physics class. So I had access to all these students and I made them go online and they were randomly assigned to see a video. One of which I called the exposition, which was essentially just like a lecturer being like, look, here's the deal with Newton's first law. And it would be like textbook definition. We actually pulled the definition out of a textbook. And then we would like illustrate it with like animations. We'd get people to do like an actual demonstration, either with like juggling balls or with a car going up and down a ramp, or, you know, like all these sorts of real world examples. We'd have like graphs, animations, like basically everything you can show a kid to explain it as clearly as you can. So they'd come out of that, they'd feel confident, they would feel like the video was a good use of their time, they'd feel like they learned something. And then we would look at their pre and post test scores. And for the fundamental students, that is students who hadn't had a strong background in physics, there was no gain, like statistically zero improvement. But if we showed those students a video where there was a dialogue between someone who was like pretending to be a student and someone who was pretending to be a tutor, and the student would say something wrong, like, you know, I think when I throw the ball in the air, there's a force in the ball that drives it up against the force of gravity, and then at the top, gravity wins, or at the top they're balanced, and then gravity wins, and the ball falls down. And then the student and the tutor would like continue to talk, and they'd eventually come around to the right thing. But the point is, we would add in this one video, we would add multiple incorrect conceptions of like what the graph should look like. Oh, I think it should look like this. And like, does that make sense? Because should it look like... So anyway, so we made something that was more complicated, but something that was a dialogue between a student and a tutor where the student had the most common misconceptions. That video presentation doubled their scores.
That's really cool. It took longer,
but it actually addressed their prior knowledge. You could have said, looking at us going in to do the experiment, that we were going to screw kids up doing that, because we were like actually presenting and illustrating, animating misconceptions.
Yeah.
But people were smart enough to follow the whole, you know, dialogue and realize which was the right answer and which was the common wrong answer, which was also talked about in that video. So that turned out to be more effective.
Man, that is so powerful. That basically shows a win for the Socratic method in some sense, because, you know, the whole Socrates method is ask questions and kind of guide the person to that answer. That's a little bit different, though, because you're actually saying that the questions are even the wrong ones, and then they can maybe even explain why it's wrong.
Or the answers are the wrong ones, and that's partly, you know, where the Socratic dialogue comes in. I mean, that played into my thinking a lot, this idea of vicarious learning or Socratic learning, this idea that, like, in lectures, what we kind of need is question asking, but that doesn't happen very often because, you know, students don't feel like, you know, I don't want to be the one who looks like an idiot and whatever, and I don't want to slow us down or whatever. And because of that, the questions don't get asked. And because of that, you know, the class just moves on and the teacher thinks everyone's following, but they're not. So I feel like that's the most common sort of one of the most common issues. By the way, I should mention, we showed the same sorts of presentations to advanced stream of students who had more of a background in physics, and then all the videos were equally effective.
Very
partly that could be to a ceiling effect, like they came in and scored high enough on the pretest that there wasn't enough room to show whatever the gain.
Gotcha.
But like all the videos seemed to be similarly effective if you had more prior knowledge. It was like just the refresher helped them. Mm. But the lower the prior knowledge, or the lower the sort of background in physics, the more important it was to address these sort of misconceptions, which I think makes sense.
Dang. Derek, if you ever are going to make another video, you should do it on this. I feel like I think I want to see that very badly.
I think the video in Science of Thinking is kind of there. I also made a video way back, you know, called Khan Academy and the Effectiveness of Science Videos or something. Because it's kind of this idea of like being really clear is not a great strategy in areas where there are common misconceptions. Because it'll make people think that they get it, but they won't actually get it. So, anyway, if you want to see my videos on that, there's that. I also made like a kind of TED talk about this. So,
yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, there's really stuff out there. Expertise as well.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. So, I guess, Derek, you said you weren't so enthralled with research, but did you actually have to do research during your undergraduate?
I got involved in some projects. One thing I got involved with was the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory in Canada. So in the summer after third year, I went up and, you know, helped out with detector operations for this like giant sphere of heavy water, a couple miles, probably about a mile underground that was detecting neutrinos. So that, you know, that's something I got involved with. I guess something else was like in fourth year, we did a research project. Mine was on like an object location device, kind of like a radio frequency identification device, kind of tag for finding lost objects, things like that. So, I mean, that's a certain amount of research, I guess, to an extent.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, that does.
Save physics education research, right? If you could go do research right now, drop everything, like, what would you study? What problem?
Go be a researcher?
Yeah.
If you had to.
If I had to pick something to research, I mean, like, I've thought a lot about, you know, how a lot of stuff in the biospace is pretty exciting right now, like around, say, CRISPR or you know, a lot of the stuff that's happening around genetics, and I think that's interesting. Why, you know, looking at what's happening in terms of anti-aging and sort of life extension type research, I feel like there's a lot of interesting stuff there. If I were on the science side, or like the sort of more physics side, I wonder where would I put my efforts? I feel like one of the challenges is like I'm kind of turned off by, you know, CERN style big science, you know, just feels like you're a tiny cog. Like one of the things for me was like I always wanted to feel like I was making this kind of unique contribution, and I don't know, in that area it becomes, I don't know. Again, this is just like, I feel like this is a personality thing more than it is like a, you know, actual problem with the research. It's just like, and this is something that I counsel to anyone out there who's in science, is to think about, you know, like what's the day-to-day work of it? Would I have loved to have made the contributions that Einstein made? Yeah. You know, if I could have done the quantum, you know, electrodynamics papers and stuff, you know, like, yeah, great. If I could have explained the photoelectric effect, like that feels like something I could have done. Maybe, but maybe I'm fooling myself. but you know what I mean? That all seems like amazing. I would have loved to do that. But what is the day-to-day work of being doing that job? And I just feel like it's not a great mesh for my personality, which is, you know, I want to be, you know, I love learning about science. So like doing what I do now is great because I get to learn about it. And then I get to sort of figure out a creative way to talk about it and show it. And then I get to move on and do something else. So, you know, I'm not, you know, setting a year of my life or 5 years of my life, you know, studying C. elegans or something. That's a little worm, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. I'm sure that's cool, but like, it's not for me. So,
no, I think I'm right there with you.
I can make one bomb video about it, and then but then I can move on. You know, I don't have to, you know, spend 10 years. So I really think it's a personality thing.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you, man. That's why I'm kind of hoping that I can somehow get this podcast enough money to where I can just do my own physics.
Yeah.
Kind of in the same realm as you, you know, where you can have
you can
do the things that interest you instead of having to go 5 years hard onto one tiny, tiny subset of a field.
Yep.
But really, we wanted you to just say condensed matter physics was the best area of research.
Yeah, I was looking for that.
I was just thinking of that in my head. I was like, would I say material science? There's something about material science that always has seemed like uncool to me. But
yeah, I get
just
it.
Just because it's like, you know, it's like it's materials, whatever. It's like, this is made out of steel. This is but like simultaneously, I think there is cool stuff there. So like if someone comes up with a high temperature superconductor, that's killer.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever.
Quantum computers are in that realm too. In some sense.
Yeah.
So we got some cool stuff.
Yeah.
Don't be a hater.
I got it.
Yeah.
When it gets discovered, I'll come and film it and I'll make an awesome video about it.
So. Sweet, man. Cool. Sweet.
Good stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I just kind of wanted to get more into like, you know, physicists get this bad rep, not bad rep, but we kind of get characterized as like nerdy kind of, you know,
very stereotypically characterized, but I mean, it makes sense.
Sheldon,
right?
From you know, the Big Bang Theory. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You kind of rolled your eyes a little bit there.
I don't think I rolled my eyes. You can watch the tape. I did not roll my eyes. I was thinking about it.
Internally, he rolled his eyes.
So here's my thought about that. You know, there's people maybe like you guys, or maybe like me, or, you know, I know some other people who love to get out there and on social media and say like, look, you know, we're not all crazy nerds. We're like, some of us are fun people and, you know, we can go have a blast or whatever. But my sense is, you know, the people who are saying those sorts of things are typically people who are more on like the science communication end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Like, because like, we have social skills, and because, you know, look, I don't want to talk badly about our compatriots. The point being, like, if you really enjoy your research and being there, you know, 24/7 or whatever, and you're really into it, you typically have less of an interest in sort of being an extrovert or being, you know, on a podcast or something like that. So I feel like there is this natural stratification. There's a reason why, you know, certain personality types are attracted to certain types of work, and like, I don't know. To me, that feels like that explains a certain amount of the stereotype. And as much as we want to say like, you know, cool people do science too, like Brian Cox or, you know, Bill Nye, it's like, yeah, but they didn't end up just doing science because like their personality and their skill set is more suited to this thing that's, you know, the science communication side.
Very
so
true.
Anyway, that's my sense, is that like maybe the stereotypes are, you know, somewhat deserved, and I don't know, that's okay. Like
yeah,
different people,
yeah.
different personality types like different things.
Yeah. Well,
very good answer.
Yeah. Speaking of like Brian Cox, right? He used to be in like a band. Did you ever did you ever play music or do
anything?
I did.
I was actually in a band too.
Cool.
I played like the engineering bar back at Queens.
Cool.
I was like, in theory, the lead singer of our band, but like, I don't think I was very good because we didn't make it very far, you know. I sang in another band in Australia. You know, like, early on in the Veritasium channel, the thing I thought that was going to take it big was these like scientific music videos. Made a video about gravity, you know, John Mayer's song Gravity, but made it actually about gravity. I took this duet from like Miss Saigon and made it about atomic bonding. What else did I do? I did like Jason Mraz, I'm Yours, but I changed it to I'm Adams, and it was all about chemistry. So I really thought that's the thing that was gonna blow up for me. Did not happen. So I've stopped making the. You know, I even have a song about friction.
Yeah.
But I've never released it. But yeah, it's the song from Santana featuring Rob Thomas called Smooth.
Right.
The song's
all about.
It's classic.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I was in a band. I was in a couple bands, and I also played French horn. So yeah, I have a sort of musical background. Yeah.
Dang, that's a difficult one.
Yeah, he knows about classical music than I.
Yeah, because the French horn's the one that you got to stick your hand in there, and it's oof. When you hear bad French horn players, it's really bad.
That's true. It's like most bad instruments. Yeah, it can sound really terrible.
But especially there's something about the brass ones where it's just like, dang. It's really hard to play those instruments. I feel for them. Your people.
Yeah.
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 Did you have any other hobbies, I guess, besides playing instruments and stuff?
Instruments, bands. I enjoyed running, going to the beach. You know, I moved back to Sydney after college, and that's where I did my PhD. But, you know, going to the beach there a lot was one of my favorite things to do, or going on hikes and stuff. Yesterday, I was out trying to hike with the family. We were trying to go on this, like, two-mile loop. And, like, we thought maybe we got to, like, the halfway point. We were about to go back on the loop.
Right.
And like, I had a look at the map, and I was like, oh, man, we gone, like, 500 feet. Oh, no. And at this point, we had, like, both kids in meltdown mode.
Oh, no. Oh,
one was like, I'm not walking. The other one was like, yeah, he was just running around in circles. And anyway, so I ended up, like, kind of carrying both of them back down the hill. It was rough. It was brutal. And we're trying to, like, be socially distant. My older one's like, I need to hold my mask. And anyway, you know, the whole thing. So
speaking of dad problems, I guess we're going to be wrapping up in a bit, but are you like hoping that your kids turn into scientists, or are you being like more holistic, I guess, just saying like, you know, I'm going to let you be what you want to be kind of thing?
Like, I feel like at the minute I don't have to make a strong decision on how I'm going to behave vis-a-vis, you know, questions like that. Like, idealistically, my vision for being a parent is that I will be very open with my kids, and that I won't force them to, you know, do the things that I like or find things interesting the way I find them interesting. It's still going to be tough if my kids aren't like academically inclined, because I was, you know, so it's going to feel weird if they're not into studying or like getting good grades or, you know, excelling in that part of their lives. And it'll probably cause me some deep distress. But I want to find a way to be okay with that.
Yeah.
But I don't know if I will be, you know, because like at my core, I'm a teacher. I'm, you know, someone who seeks like knowledge is really useful and helpful, and it's powerful, and like we should embrace it. And, you know, I'm just going to want to jump in there and be like, no, come sit with me and like, let's work this out, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because
I'm going to try to fight that urge. Like,
yeah.
I want them to do the things they want to do. As long as they've got things that they're passionate in and like that they want to focus on and spend time on, then that's cool. How would I take it if my kid turned out to be like a gamer and he just wants to sit in front of his computer 24/7? Like, that's going to be hard.
Hey, bro, but gamers are making money.
I know. That's right. So, like, who am I to say?
Yeah.
Right?
If he's on Twitch streaming, you know, making bank.
That's right.
Gotta let him do his
Hands
thing,
off.
You know?
That's right.
You never know. Be
yeah,
the next
I know.
Ninja.
That's the hard part. Well, there's a lot of years before you end up making bank on Twitch. So, I mean, that's a challenge.
Yeah. Cool. Well,
yeah, man. I know you got a, you pretty much said that you...
We don't want to keep...
Yeah, we don't want to keep you too long. But we just want to say thank you.
Yes, Derek, it was a great pleasure, man. And we've learned a lot today for sure.
Yeah.
As I'm sure our viewership will as well. But yeah, I guess let's start wrapping up. I guess to close it out, Derek, I wanted to ask you a fun question. So,
these all have been fun questions.
Oh, great. But this one is a little bit out there, but
fun squared.
Yeah. So my question to you, I've asked this to other viewers. What do you think about UFOs, man? Aliens.
Oh no.
What do I think about UFOs?
Yeah.
I was thinking about this last night, actually, strangely. The reason I was thinking about it was because I was thinking, like, do I want to have a conversation with say another YouTuber who's maybe a conspiracy theorist or on some sort of a weird part of the political
subgroup.
Spectrum,
yeah.
Which leads them to promote certain things or whatever.
Uh-oh,
and I was thinking
us?
Like I was thinking like UFO is something that I could probably bring up without touching on political issues as like a kind of issue to deal with where like some people believe these things exist and other people don't. Like And the question I always want to ask is, like, how would you know if you're wrong? So I was even thinking about this last night about myself. Like, so my take on UFOs, okay? People can see things. They're not aliens, probably. Aliens probably have never come to us. Aliens probably do exist in other parts of our universe. Our universe is probably too vast for them to have come to us. And even if they were around, would they bother coming to have a look or you know, interfere with what's going on in our lives? Probably not. I don't know. That's my feeling about UFOs. How would I know if I was wrong? I was like, well, if suddenly like some sort of death ray came out of the sky and like the earth was blowing up, like in the last seconds before I blew up, I'd be like, man, I was wrong. There's aliens out there and they're mean. How else would I know if I was wrong? I was like, what if I had a personal experience with an alien? And then I was like, even that, like as convincing as that would be, I would feel like the conclusion that I was having some weird hallucination and was like ill or had a tumor like would be a more likely path than like aliens have come and shown me something. I don't know what kind of evidence, like I guess if the whole world embraced it, if the government said, you know, we've detected these objects, you can see them at the night, they look like this, they're sending us messages. I don't know, if SETI was involved and was saying, like, we've picked up this cryptographic message, we're sending it around to all these researchers, we're trying to... I don't know. I feel like there are things that might change my mind about the existence of UFOs. As of right now, I would say that people see things and make up whatever they want to believe and, you know, just given the scale of our universe and such, like...
Yeah.
Aliens exist. They probably haven't visited us.
I think truthfully, anybody, the generation that grew up with X-Files, you know, you want to believe.
Do we? The truth is out there.
Yeah. The truth is out there.
It would be cool. It would just, yeah. But nevertheless.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Well, Derek, we appreciate you, man. Once again, guys, make sure to check out Veritasium. I'm sure everybody knows you already. It's probably your viewership coming to us, if anything. But you know, guys, check them out on Twitter, Veritasium at Twitter, on Instagram, Veritasium, the Veritasium.com website. And Derek, you also have some interesting stuff for sale, though. Snatums look pretty cool. You want to talk about that or any future projects you have coming up, man?
I do have some Snatums lying around. You know, like I used to teach like chemistry type stuff. So, you know, when those really strong little spherical magnets came out, I was thinking like, wouldn't it be cool if we had an atom kit where it's like ball and sticks, but there's no sticks and the atoms just connect magnetically to each other. So that is what Snatums are. I kickstarted that 5 years ago and I still sell them to this day on Amazon and Snatums.com. So if anyone wants to check them out, they can. I just made a new version of the big kit where there's now little holes in the sides where the magnets are, so the magnets can actually touch each other. Before they were behind plastic, I was a little bit paranoid. Like magnets would come out, people would swallow them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But yeah. So now they can stick together and they're a little stronger bonding and stuff like that. So yeah.
Cool.
Cool stuff.
Any other projects?
That's about it. I got another kid coming in 6 weeks.
Oh, so. That's an 18-year project. Yeah, it's an 18-year project. That's a huge
probably one. More.
I'm going to be busy. Yeah, there might be more projects coming out on YouTube soon, like some bigger YouTube stuff. But that's probably as much as I can say about it at the minute. But yeah, that's where I want to focus my energy now. Like I love doing YouTube, and you know, if I can just do that, like I'll be happy.
Cool,
awesome, man.
Well, congrats on the kid. And
thank you.
Yeah, and all the success, man. It was great.
Yes,
talking
indeed.
To you.
All right, Derek. Thanks so much, man. And we will see you guys and see you all later. Ta-ta.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
No problem.
I was gonna make a joke, but I couldn't fit it in.
Oh, no, because I was talking too much.
No, because
that was great, man.
It was about how you were born in Australia and you moved to Canada. And then, like I was like, did you have, like, a crisis almost of identity where you were just, like, saying things like, you call that a knife, eh?
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. You should have thrown that in there.
Or like
a knife, eh? So you've played knifey spoony before.
I'm sorry that a dingo ate your baby.
Yeah. Yep. Like these are great. These are fire. Yeah, you should put these in. Just cut into the podcast and be like, yeah, I'm doing it.